One of the things when you talk to an expert in any field is that they have their passion, they have maybe their area of discipline, but generally they also have a private passion, the kind of subset of their discipline that they devote their time and their kind of extracurricular reading activity to, and they can't shake it off. I listened to Colin Bissett doing our iconic building sometime and notice how often Le Corbusier gets mentioned. It's Colin can't get enough of the man and his work. And our next guest is someone that's also true of. He's program director of the design school at the University of New South Wales, and his name is Dr. Mark Jones, and his passion is the work of Vic Lindstrand, Swedish designer. He's written a new book on the subject. It's called Vic Lindstrand on the Periphery, and he joins us now. G'day, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. So when did the interest in Swedish design begin for you?
For me, probably as a teenager, I had three uncles that were artists, and in the 1970s, they had pretty groovy houses, lots of Scandinavian furniture and glass and those sorts of things. So it started early for me.
Help me out here. How does the Swedish part of it fit into broader Scandinavian design? When did the umbrella term Scandinavian come to the fore, and what does the Swedish part of it look like?
Okay, well, Scandinavian design became a thing, if you like, in the 1950s. Post-World War II, it was a way of kind of bringing the Nordic countries together, sort of as a defence, I guess, in the Cold War, and to push that whole democratic idea to the rest of the world. The Swedish part of that started much earlier. Sweden has a long history of social democratic politics, and in unison with that was a very strong society of arts and crafts that pushed a social agenda to try and get better design to the masses. So Sweden was very successful in marketing themselves and getting their design out to the world from as early as the 1920s, 1930s, the New York World's Fair in 1939. They also had great success at. So they've been at it quite a long time.
So it genuinely epitomises that idea of politics meeting design. The socialist democratic politics had a marked influence on the design outcomes.
Very much so. In Sweden, it was, at the time, it was a receptive political kind of movement. As I said, in unison with the design organisations that made that possible. And that's manifest in how people view Scandinavian design today. You know, it's always put forward as an example of good design or, excellence in design.
You mentioned, though, I mean, it's that first half of the 20th century that's pivotal, kind of 20s, 30s. What role did World War II play in all of this?
Well, Sweden was neutral during World War II, and in lots of ways it presented an opportunity because Norway and Denmark were occupied. A lot of designers moved to Sweden during that time, and it really started this whole cooperative, cross-Nordic relationship that really became this Scandinavian design idea in the 1950s.
I'm always vaguely suspect that the rise of these schools is in part as much a kind of ordering mechanism or a marketing tool even as it is an aesthetic thing. Can you talk us through the kind of particular design aesthetic that was coming out of the region at that time?
Well, it's always that sort of pared down, simple, clean lines. You hear those sorts of things. Not terribly colourful, sort of very much entrenched in a craft tradition. And that idea was really first put forward by Sweden in the way they had promoted themselves, things like Swedish Modern in the 1930s. And certainly by the 1950s, there was this idea to market, Nordic design to the rest of the world. And so Scandinavian design became a marketing tool in lots of ways to get design from the region out and to present it as this kind of unison idea that it wasn't necessarily.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, one of the dangers of that kind of evolution of a design school is that it can lead to a kind of stereotypical view of what it looks like, a kind of this is the unilateral face of Scandinavian design. Do you think what we think of when we think of Scandinavian design now is too limited?
Very much so, yeah. It's all a fairly well-constructed stereotype. It's not representative of everything that happened and does happen in Scandinavia, or the Nordic region, as they prefer to be known these days. And certainly at, you know, in the 1950s, what was very successfully presented and what we think of now as Scandinavian design wasn't at all representative of what the majority of designers were doing.
Well, we've covered the context in the school. Let's go to the man himself who has piqued your interest. Tell us about the subject of your book, Vic Lindstrand.
Okay, well, Vic Lindstrand was a very successful Swedish artist and designer. Started his career as an illustrator in Gothenburg in the 1920s. He worked for the very famous glassworks Orrefors as a young designer in the 1930s, became very successful there. 1940s, he worked for a ceramics company, Uppsala Ekeby, and also designed textiles, did illustrations for children's books, a whole range of things. In the 1950s, he, through to the 1970s, he worked for Costa, which we know as Costa Boda, and was the artistic director there for 23 years.
Wow.
He exhibited in all the major exhibitions of the 20th century that really defined modernism in lots of ways, and particularly Scandinavian design. But the work that was selected of his for these exhibitions was always that which fit this particular stereotype. And I became interested in what I was seeing, which was, I didn't think, representative of the breadth of the work that he had done.
So, sorry, just so that I've got this right. So for the exhibitions, they were singling out the stuff that was kind of more conformist and more archetypal, but that wasn't representative of his work?
Very much so, yeah. He was, you know, in the 1950s, because there was this big push for Scandinavian design, and he's looking at people like Jackson Pollock and abstract expressionism and, you know, Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth and all these kind of, and, you know, more exotic influences to, you know, Asian cultures for inspiration. And to my mind, that's where the interesting aspects of his work are. But very much it was the stereotypical pared down clean lines.
Let's hear a bit of some of those kind of specific examples of the bits of work that you that identified him maybe as a bit of an unrecognized rebel. Give us some examples of ones that didn't fit the traditional mold.
Well, I guess if I was to sort of look at what the works of his now that people kind of hold in the most esteem, they're the ones that weren't included. And they're things like he did a series of vases for Costa that use threads of coloured glass in a way that's a little bit like what Jackson Pollock was doing in some of his paintings, like blue poles and things like that. He would use engravings of, you know, exotic pearl divers, for instance, in the 1930s when he was at Orifice. You know, that's an exotic activity that certainly doesn't take place in Sweden. And the things that they did pick were the things that were more stereotypically Swedish. So rather than picking, you know, an exotic scene of a bullfighter, for instance, they would pick a scene of a fishing village because that was seen to be more Swedish.
Mark, when did you first come across his work?
Probably about 2003. I became aware of his work just, you know, I'd always been a bit of a collector, which is a bit of a peril. And I saw some of his work at the Sydney Antique Centre and became interested in what I saw. I bought a piece on eBay some years ago and tried to find out a bit more information about him. And the more I looked, the less I found. And so that became kind of a mission for me to find out more about him. I read some fairly direct opinions by some Swedish art historians that were quite dismissive of his work. And in lots of ways, that became a catalyst for me undertaking some private research that turned into a PhD and now the book.
And so you visited Scandinavia as part of your research. How did you find his work was perceived there? Entirely through the lens of the exhibited more conventional stuff?
I found a duality of how it was viewed. There were people that loathed him and there were people that loved him, and very little in between. And that became an interesting kind of context for me to navigate as a researcher. There were people that had worked with him. He was a very forbidding character. So, you know, he wasn't that liked by some of the people he worked with. But you know, on the other hand, there was a kind of respect for him from others. You know, I looked at what was in museum collections, archives, speaking to people, and I kept coming up with this very mixed reception.
Your work is in part a work of resurrection. It's a lovely idea. Do young designers in Scandinavia now, is there a way in which they're kind of benefiting from his legacy? How does our appreciation of what Scandinavian design means impact on young Scandinavian designers? Do they need a bit more of the Lindstrand in them?
I think they do, and I know that they have it. And I think the way that Scandinavia has changed, just even in the sort of 12 or so years that I've been travelling back and forth, there's more acceptance of outside influences. And that's certainly representative in the culture and the multiculturalism that you see now in Scandinavia. And young Scandinavian designers are no longer just working for Scandinavian companies. You know, they're working for Italian companies. So they're working all over the place, and they're starting to get work that's not seen as typically Scandinavian. They're getting it out there into the marketplace. That was a problem for them for quite a while, that the hangover of this big Scandinavian design legacy.
Thanks for your time, Mark.
Thank you.
Dr. Mark Jones, Program Director, Design at University of New South Wales, and the author of Vic Lindstrand on the Periphery.